We talk about the coaching shakeups in Milwaukee and Washington. We detail the sadness surrounding the Brooklyn Nets. And we take a peek at Dan's All-Star selections. That, and you know, we got trade talk coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me, as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it is my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What is up?
Jake, the energy is incredible. The vibes are immaculate. All-star starters are about to be announced. The Washington Wizards are making changes. We're all making changes to our lighting systems and our recording setups. And whatever that analogy and metaphor means in your life, I hope that it is you're making those changes in a positive way and you're looking all friggin' lit up, listeners. Let's freaking go.
I went to a hippie Shabbat thing last weekend where the takeaways was the only Action Bronson lyric. Yeah. The only God is change. That is what this person transmitted to all of us. So we hope
Parable of the sower. Get out there. Be reading the parable of the sower. Earth seed. Big change. Oh, sorry. We are just like free associating off the top of this episode, but that's the kind of podcast that you can expect today, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what day it is. I've been on the phone nonstop for every hour possible until it's time to mercifully go to bed. But we've got all sorts of stuff, like Dan said, and we got some trade stuff. Definitely some change in the coaching ranks that we will touch on first here in our opening news items, where the biggest coaching story this week, of course, took place in Milwaukee. We'll get to that in a second. But the Washington Wizards followed suit by parting ways with Wes Unseld Jr., who is now going to be transitioning into a front office advisory position, where assistant coach Brian Keefe is expected to fill in as the interim head coach while there's going to be an official search this offseason. So after some early calls and text messages about this to be somewhat informed before we recorded, I will say that this news was definitely a little surprising for folks, being that Washington picked up Wes Unseld's option earlier this year for next season. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of history with his family in that franchise where I think no matter what was going to happen with Washington and the coaching position, he was always going to be somewhat taken care of by the franchise, just with those connections and the fact that Wes Unseld Jr. is being just consistently characterized around the league as like a super nice stand-up dude who deserves goodwill treatments and treatings, you know. So
goodwill treatments and treatings. That's going to be Vinny's third show. Goodwill treatments and treatings. But the thing that I had a couple of thoughts on this, not like anything wide ranging, but just Wes Unseld Jr. It's whatever, like more than a decade as an assistant, almost I guess like 15 years as an assistant head coach, first in Washington, then Golden State, Orlando, with the Nuggets as part of their sort of rise before he gets his first head coaching gig. And then, like, as so often happens, we saw it with Steven Silas. We've seen it with so many other coaches over the years, Jacques Vaughn in Orlando, his first time around. The first gig you get is often a job that's sort of a fixer-upper. And there's been so much upheaval, you know, the moving from the Russell Westbrook deal and the Bradley Beal and, you know, the Bradley Beal injuries and then tanking and he's not in the lineup all that much. And you switch out Spencer Dinwiddie and Kristaps Porzingis. And there's just like so much. There hasn't been a consistent core to really build around there before you even get to now this summer. It's Jordan Poole and it's Kyle Kuzma and it's a new front office that did not hire Wes Unseld Jr. With Michael Winger and company. So like this feels to me like you see it sometimes in college football too. Like we're making our firing early so that we can be at the front of the line in the next hiring cycle. Like so that everybody knows when the coaching carousel starts up, like, we want to be considered as, or have our first pick or be able to do our interviews while other teams are getting ready for bowl games or whatever. and so I wonder if this is like, while, you know, your point about it's the timing is surprising because like, what would be the point of the Wizards getting a head start now? It's like, maybe it's just get all our ducks in a row and make sure we know exactly who we want to interview, what kind of coach we want. you know, who fits that bill, and then, you know, hit the ground running once the season ends. But unfortunate for Wes Unseld Jr., who did not really get half a chance to do a half decent job, but probably time for a new start in Washington, as pretty much everything is requiring a new start in Washington.
Yeah, this is going to be a years-long rebuild. That's what's being evidenced by what the Wizards are telling rival teams during trade deadline conversations, that they're setting these price points for Kyle Kuzma and Tyus Jones and Daniel Gafford and DeLon Wright and down the roster. And like a lot of teams, you know, they'll look at the Hawks asking for two picks and something for DeJounte Murray, or the Nets wanting a first round pick for Royce O'Neal and twos for Dorian Finney-Smith. And teams will say, oh, that team will come down. Like their asking price of first come February 8th at 2 o'clock Eastern time, that'll be 2 seconds. The Wizards, I don't think that's the case. They don't have to make any trades. They are bad, and they're going to continue to be bad. And they are looking to recoup as much future draft capital as they can, being that they got some valuable swaps, I think, from Phoenix in that Bradley Beal mega deal. But you don't get back the four unprotected picks that the Rockets have from the James Harden trade to Brooklyn, and then the Nets have from trading KD to Phoenix after the James Harden trade to Brooklyn didn't work out. So I think there's like the longest view in the room that Sam Hinkie coined. Like, I think you might even make that even longer in Washington, where Michael Winger and Will Dawkins, his number two or number three, depending on what the hierarchy is there with Travis Schlenk, those guys come from Oklahoma City originally, that coined the longest term or longest view in the room term before Sam Hinkie even got able to co-opt it. And I think also one thing that I learned, it does seem like Washington had their eye on Mark Dagnall from OKC in the event that his extension stuff never worked out with the Thunder. Now, number two or three, wherever the Thunder stand in the West currently as of recording, and everything seeming to be trending with a direct arrow upward, that's not going to be likely no longer.
Yeah. They're not letting him get out of the city limits there. They want to have him around for a good long time.
But I think that just is a data point to show what type of person could be the type of what type of coach and the goal of like being a player development, young, scrappy, upstart team coach guy. That's going to be what I think Washington's looking for.
Yeah, maybe like their version of the Jazz going and getting Will Hardy and saying like, you have a super long runway. Like, let's, you know, you're a young coach with promise, and we see an opportunity to kind of go build from the ground up, like years before Danny Ainge did with Brad Stevens. You know, like, we understand the road ahead of us, and we're going to give somebody that rope. It's just unfortunate that did not happen for Wes Unseld Jr., but so on.
So to Milwaukee, where definitely bigger, more consequential news is Adrian Griffin out. Vinny Goodwill,
wait, what?
Of course.
Where have I been?
Was that your reaction when the news got levied on Tuesday?
I think my reaction was, I got it right. let me check with guards and see if I need to write. No, yeah, I mean, and I feel like the big response that we've seen so much of the last couple of days is like, it is shocking and it is not shocking. And it's like, mm-hmm, holding those two thoughts together at once. Like, you do not fire somebody who has won like 70% of his games in his first half season as a head coach. And everybody looked at it and was like, that is a paper tiger. Those numbers are inflated. Strength of schedule, the opponents they've played, the bad defense, yada, yada, yada. We've all written some version of that. I wrote about it. You wrote about it. You actually reported and talked to people. I just threw some shit at the wall and saw what stuck. But, you know, Vinny had talked to Adrian Griffin like two nights earlier. So yeah, you know, he was first of the hole on that and actually had like Adrian Griffin's response, which was kind of amazing, or commentary from him rather about the state of affairs. But yeah, I think we all looked at it and said, if this is the best the Bucks are going to be able to do schematically and with that personnel, it's not going to be good enough against this Celtics team, this version of Embiid, the Sixers that are like more versatile and varying in terms of the way that they attack, let alone whoever comes out of the West. So the Bucks saw that too, and they saw it up close and personal a lot, you know, more clearly than we did. And so Adrian Griffin winds up on the outside looking in.
Yeah, I think, you know, talking to a ton of people about this over the last 48 hours, one of my first thoughts here, like, yes, The timing was surprising, but all the reasons below the iceberg, you know, tip were not. And starting to wonder, like, man, if hindsight being 2020, I wonder if Milwaukee wishes they just, when Terry Stotts walked in to resign, if they said, actually, hold up, maybe we should be keeping you, and how much different a situation that would have been. Because from my understanding, I know The Athletic reported Doc Rivers first got intertwined with Milwaukee when he just coincidentally happened to be in Las Vegas covering the in-season tournament games for ESPN's broadcast. And I mean, I've definitely heard that they started that Milwaukee started making outreach to potential candidates such as Doc and Nate McMillan like late November. So even before we went to Vegas, and people were asking their friends in the coaching community, what do you think about that job? Like, well before all of this. So like, that makes people wonder, like, was there a direct incident that made this happen now? I think it's just truly, like, as I wrote, I think it's truly the fact that Milwaukee has real championship or bust expectations, in that if they bust, there's no assurances Giannis Antetokounmpo is going to be wanting to stick around, even though he signed a 3-year, $180 million extension. That's just how today's NBA works. And he had already taken to the press and local podcasts and what have you on multiple occasions to indicate that if he felt there were other opportunities elsewhere to better compete for multiple championships, he was going to be very keen on pursuing them. So that's what makes you make a Damian Lillard trade, which again, they did before they hired Adrian Griffin well before that deal became available. And you can say, look, like, oh, Milwaukee probably had the thought they could have gotten Dame. I'm not so certain about that, because Adrian Griffin got hired back. I remember like those conversations were being done in late May during the combine and pre-draft. Like, I don't think Milwaukee, from my understanding, really became a real player for Dame until in the fall, when it started to become clear to Damian Lillard's camp that Portland wasn't trading that dude to Miami. Right. And that's when you started to hear the back channel stuff to Milwaukee and to Brooklyn and trying to look at other possible landing spots. So the job in general, to be a first-time head coach trying to keep Giannis Antetokounmpo comfortable and winning, was going to be a challenge to begin with. It got even harder when you swapped out the personnel of Damian Lillard or Jrue Holiday for Damian Lillard, and the Grayson Allen to Malik Beasley downgrade. I wanted to highlight in my story, that's something I heard a lot of people mention too, especially as Grayson Allen's is balling out in Phoenix. Like, he's been arguably their most important player all year, being that he's the one who's played all year.
I would argue that the Devin Booker is a more important player than, but I hear what you're saying. I get the framing.
When one of Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, or Bradley Beal has been out, he's been there. Kevin hasn't missed much time.
Sure.
But yeah, you get my point. So it's just interesting where they go from here, because the personnel thing was leading me to say, like, the Bucks were already being very explorative in what they could get on this market. I think John Horst's front office has always been super opportunistic. I mean, I think back to that deal at the 2021 trade deadline, where they basically had no first round picks to move at all, and they still figure out a way to change protections and delay certain conveyances. I don't remember exactly what. I even tried to look at it before I wrote the story. It was like, just too confusing, because that's the type of real chicanery and creativity that was done there to get PJ Tucker and make Houston feel like they were getting the first round capital back that they wanted for him. This trade for Dame that came out of nowhere. Like, they're trying to figure out what they can do with this number 35 pick that's coming from Portland, that some people, depending on how you look at it, could either be more valuable or equal to a late first round pick, with the tax implications. A second rounder is far less on the luxury tax bill than a first rounder, and you're not bound to the rookie scale deal and all that type of stuff. It was basically enough to lubricate whatever final pieces needed to get across the finish line between Toronto and New York for OG Anunoby, with that Detroit pick, that number 31 pick. That's basically, you know, a late first pick in the second. So this is similar to that. But like, I don't know how much better Milwaukee can get with a $12.5 million outgoing salary combination of Pat Connaughton and campaign on this market. And I don't know how much better they're going to be able to get when you throw in Bobby Portis' salary to get up to the Bruce Browns and the DeJounte Murrays. And like, is that really worth giving up Bobby Portis? I'm not so certain. So we'll see what they can do there. But like the other changes that are going to be coming, and the word about, oh, Doc's going to want to bring in some of his assistants, which like, of course, two things there of note, like Adrian Griffin really didn't get to do that. Like Terry Stotts was someone who was hired by the front office. So a little bit of a change, I think, maybe from their past missteps there. But also like a lot of Doc's assistants, like Dave Yeager, I know has had conversations. I know that's been reported, but I can confirm there's been an actual conversation that's taken place so far at this juncture. Like that dude's a multi-time head coach, and those types of assistants don't come cheap. And the Bucks are now paying three head coaches, and Doc's making $10 million with Mike Budenholzer somewhere around $8 million for year after year after year now. Like, how much more are you going to be shelling out to fix a coaching staff when you have two max contracts and then Chris Middleton on a huge deal and Brooke Lopez on a huge deal? It's just, it's going to be a very pricey, costly thing to fix on the fly. But again, all that stuff has this North Star of trying to compete with Giannis while he's still in town. So at the end of the day, that's going to be the motivating factor. And if it's a couple of dollars and cents here, I wonder how frugal Milwaukee's going to be when they know that's what the real ramifications are here.
This is the cost of doing business when the business that you want to do is competing for a championship year in and year out around one of the greatest players of all time and one of the most important players in the history of your franchise. This is why, I'm sorry, I just realized your shirt has all of the NBA logos on it. It is, if you're not watching this on YouTube, get over there immediately to see Jake's shirt. And now I'm very conscious of my own shirt, which Will Liu of Sportsnet in Canada once called the Pro Basketball Writers Association of America, or Pro Basketball Writers Association like uniform, just like a blue flannel, like on a boring ass white guy. Anyway, sorry, that's really distracting.
My shirt has every logo from every NBA team circa 2009. And it's my favorite like music festival concert shirt that I've stopped wearing after I got recognized one time in an environment that I don't necessarily want to be recognized in.
That's fair. Yeah. Whereas I can just be anonymous in this shirt. Like I completely blend into any wallpaper, especially blue gingham patterns. The Bucks. Yes. If you want to be competing for championships now in this era of the NBA, it is a perpetual all-in bet. Every opportunity you get, you have to go all in all the time. You have to do it. And Giannis is proving himself to be a real student of the game as laid out by LeBron James years ago, that like you are, or like, you know, like the NIL version of the game, like you are always recruiting me. You never have to stop recruiting me. Even though I signed on the dotted line, you still need to burn every asset we have, put whatever we can in the middle to get better today to win tonight. Like that's the goal all the time. And that is what his greatness demands, right? That is what these players at the highest level require of their franchises. And so like now LeBron has dealt with the backside of that too. Like, there comes a point where you look at the roster of the team that you have spent 4 years constructing and, you know, trying to drag to finals and being like, well, that is a withered husk of what used to be. And now it's time for me to go find a new place to do business that has more assets and more youth and more opportunity, more resources to develop. The possibility of that day coming in Milwaukee, like the Bucks can't discount that just because Giannis is a good guy, right? Like that still absolutely could be the case. And Giannis has been pretty straightforward in all of these venues being like, we need to be more organized. The defense has to get better. We're the Milwaukee Bucks. This is not who we are. And also we need to be winning another one. Otherwise, like, I don't know what's going to happen. He's been like extraordinarily clear about this. So
he has not beaten around the bush one iota.
No, he's been like telling, like, I can't be yelling this loudly enough. And so the Bucks have acted accordingly. And whether Doc Rivers is that guy, I mean, you mentioned the concern about like how much better can you get with that personnel? How much better can Doc Rivers, who has not I mean, I don't know exactly how you evaluate Doc Rivers as a coach, because he feels simultaneously like way overrated. And then because of how much people talk about him being overrated, it's like, well, maybe we're not showing enough respect for what he can actually do. Like, step one is just like, if you get Giannis to believe in what you are schematically putting out there and asking him to do, that's a giant, that's the main thing you can do. Get buy-in from Giannis immediately and, you know, earn his respect, command that. That gets everything else sort of moved in the same direction. Shy of that, like, if you don't have good defenders, don't ask them to defend 40 feet away from the basket. Play more conservative. Bring back,
In Vegas, when Doc was getting ready to take over the job that he was advising about.
Allegedly.
It was very stark to me to notice Malik Beasley was the one flanking Tyrese Haliburton from 94 feet away.
It's just like, don't like leave your flank wide open if you can avoid it, right? If there's a vulnerable part of you, cover it up as best you can. And so I think the best way the Bucks can do that, I know Brian Sampson at Bucks Film Room has done some really good, you know, evaluation work on that defensive scheme and what the issues are with it. Play it tight, play it close to the vest, reduce possessions, try to keep, you know, force guys to finish over your length, similar to how things have gone before. You don't have the great point of attack defenders, the guys with the rear view contests, all that kind of stuff. But that's the framework. That's the formula. And the whole goal was, we are going to be so good offensively that even if we're like average or around there defensively, that's going to make up for it. I would expect Doc Rivers will be a lot more willing to spam the pick and roll between Giannis and Damian Lillard. I would imagine he's like, there will be a sort of simplification and streamlining of what they're doing. Yes, you need to be scheme versatile. Yes, you need to have more ways to skin the cat, but like, get your A game straight first. Beat him with your fastball if you can.
Yeah.
And that's where Milwaukee's going to go. And then, you know, if that's going to be enough, it remains to be seen. But it certainly seems like nobody involved there was confident that Adrian Griffin was going to arrive to that point, or that the players were going to get there with them. So if that's the case now, then there's no reason to wait. Might as well rip off the Band-Aid and see where you get from here.
Yeah, the straight line, if you're cutting out Adrian Griffin, of firing Mike Budenholzer largely for his rigidity and lack of adjustments to Doc Rivers, who has gone down with many a 3-2 series lead in the postseason, is not the most reassuring. But if there's one thing Doc Rivers is credited for being very, very good at, it's just like overall competency across the board for everything that encompasses a head coaching position. That's not that stuff, which I think was clearly a big struggle for Adrian Griffin to do, like to communicate the basketball stuff. But like, you got to be able to communicate it and like command the locker room and the respect and the just like overall gravitas of that chair to be able to communicate something that works, like let alone have the scheme work. And that's what Doc has always done. And we saw it the most publicly in his Clippers days, when he had to basically be the entire standard bearer of a franchise whose owner was being ousted for heinous events. And like, we saw it time and again in Boston and in Philadelphia, he was at least somewhat of a like putting a tie on the collar of that team after Brett Brown couldn't get them into sustainable, like, we are a postseason team situation. So we'll see how successful he actually is. We'll see what other moves come for Milwaukee. The last other like news item, I guess that doesn't really fit in this, but the Team USA player pool got announced on Monday. Maybe it was Tuesday. I don't remember all the days. This week was crazy. It's a 41 player pool that is highlighted by LeBron, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry. There's some young guys, Anthony Edwards, Tyrese Haliburton. Of note, every single player from the Manila World Cup roster was included. Also of note, Draymond Green and Ja Morant were not. And other thing of note, I've been told this is not like these 41 players are going to Colorado Springs and we're having tryouts. So I don't really know exactly what the process is going to be to whittle it down. For the Manila situation and that roster, it was just Steve Kerr and Grant Hill and a few other people like Sean Ford getting together and picking a team. I'm sure there's going to be lobbying and what have you. There was lobbying and what have you to get onto this final group for a lot of these guys. But it's one thing is clear, like this is going to be a team full of stars and talent, and one that wants to have a real like juggernaut presence in Paris. So I saw Kendall Baker with our morning newsletter picked his 12-man lineup. It's going to be really challenging to pick 12 out of that group.
I mean, well, you start with Caruso and you work down, right? That's now that I actually haven't seen the full list.
Aaron Gordon would be awesome on this. He'd be the perfect 12th man on a Team USA team.
And maybe even more than that, right? Like, you know, a FIBA big who's where it's just like, you're athletic, you can play inside and out, you can play with the ball. I mean, like we saw how positive at times Paolo Banchero was as a small ball five, but it's like, what if you had that, but sort of more solid and better defensively and, you know, better acclimated to like being a complimentary player. Anyway, we don't have to break down Team USA's roster a year out, but, or 6 months or seven
months
out.
Not a year, yeah.
But I would say like, the fact that you have like James Harden's name on there and Kawhi Leonard, I don't think Kawhi Leonard has he competed for Team USA in a tournament? Like, I know he's been in the pool before, but I think injuries or whatever else has kind of kept him from actually suiting up at a World Cup or suiting up at an Olympics. So the idea of him actually finally playing for Team USA in one of these tournaments is pretty, pretty interesting, especially considering how freaking good Kawhi has looked this season and how healthy he's looked. Yeah. Steph Curry has suited up for for Team USA since like the 2014 World Cup, maybe something like that. Or whatever it was, the World Basketball Cloud, whatever it was called before it was the World Cup. So the possibility of having some of these, like the previous generation guys, LeBron, one more run, whatever.
Embiid's going to be on this team too. They don't secure his commitment and he's not making the team.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so like where the space is for, or the spaces are for those younger guys and the World Cup guys, like Anthony Edwards is going to force himself into consideration. Tyrese Halliburton, I know you've spoken quite a bit about the would you rather, or like if you had a do over of kind of handing that team more to Tyrese Halliburton in Manila, maybe that would have been beneficial. I'll say
Mikal Bridges was without a doubt a favorite of Steve Kerr on that team as well.
Well, sure. I mean, that's take the shape of whatever container you need to put him in. Like whatever the hole is you need to fill, he can cover it. Scales up on ball usage, but also can just be a complimentary player who's going to guard somebody 94 feet. So there's an array of options. There's an embarrassment of riches, as we often see with Team USA when it comes to the Olympics. It's so much of it's going to depend on who is healthy and hasn't been coming off of a 110 game season or whatever by the time we actually get there. So, and then of course we say all this and I'm kind of joking about it, but I'm kind of not. It would not surprise me one little bit to see Alex Caruso on that freaking team. Because every coach is going to look at it and go like, yep, correct. That guy, I need him.
Yeah. I'm going rogue on the rundown.
We're bringing up
just because Mikal Bridges being selected to Team USA would be a really nice change of pace for what's going on at him in Brooklyn right now.
The vibes. Not elite in Brooklyn?
Not elite. It's just...
Not just in my apartment where I'm feeling sad and depressed, but like broadly in Brooklyn?
Yeah, like it's just been a bummer going to games at Barclays, and I haven't really even been to too many this year because I know they'll be a bummer. I'm going on Saturday to the Rockets game, and like I'm kind of planning on leaving at halftime because it's just sad. So yeah, the vibes are not as high in Brooklyn right now as they are across the river where... The Knicks are just rattling off win after win. OG Anunoby is saying three words in his postgame on the court interview with MSG Network, as he always does. Things are going great in Manhattan, as not as much so in our lovely borough, Dan Devine.
Yeah, and you don't want to take too much from one set of postgame comments after a frustrating loss, but it would not be outside the realm of possibility for members of the Nets to start feeling like overwhelmingly frustrated, considering they have lost 16 of their last 20 games. On December 8th, the Nets were 12-9 and like in playoff position. I think they were like in sixth or seventh in the East. They had a top 10 offense. They were like looking good. And they have lost 16 of their last 20 games, bottom 10 on both ends of the floor. The only teams that have a worse net rating than them in that time period are like the five worst teams in the league, like the Tankers looking for number one, Charlotte, San Antonio, Washington, Detroit, and the fifth one that is escaping my brain right now, Portland. And so the Nets are there, and that is not, I'm sorry, I should have noticed, yeah, they're directly in front of my face on your shirt. That's a dramatic downturn. I think we all sort of expected the Nets to be a team that looks like ultimately would not have the top end talent to stick in the playoff picture, especially, I mean, whatever you were hoping to get out of Ben Simmons has not come to pass because he's been injured. I saw his agent, Bernie Lee, saying like he will fix all of the Nets' problems.
And it's by the way, like there's no other agent who ever gives public commentary on a player's injury status. Like that's just a very non-traditional situation across the league. Well, usually that stuff goes through the team.
Right. Yeah. So, and I mean, as I understand it, like we're still kind of, there's still not a clear timeline for Ben's. Even if there was a clear timeline for Ben Simmons, what the clear expectations would be for Ben Simmons very much remain unclear. But anyway, the reason that the vibes are sort of coming front and center is that, yes, you mentioned rivalry week, and the Knicks beat the Nets and needed like a big fourth quarter run to do it. And they pulled it off. It was an 18-6 run in the fourth quarter to take, you know, come back and take the game. And afterward, Mikal Bridges was asked about not only the run, but the fact that many Knicks fans who were at Barclays Center, as there are always a lot of Knicks fans at Barclays Center, were chanting Nets, let's go Knicks. And it was like raining down from the rafters there at Barclays Center. And they asked Mikal Bridges what he thought about it. And his quote was pretty incredible. Quote, "You could hear in the crowd, felt like a friggin' away game when they made their run. I feel like any person in here, it's not fun when you feel like you're in an away game at home. So that's for any person sitting in here, any person alive." And that is, I mean, yeah, I can imagine that's not very fun. And Josh Hart, member of the New York Knicks, one of the 1,000 or 400 million Villanova players that currently populate the New York Knicks roster, then publicly tweeted at his former teammate and was like, "Yo, let me talk to you for a second." As a, you know, potential, you know, probably just as a bit, potentially as a, you know, hey, maybe see if you could make your way over, you know, come over to death row. And
I think it's a bit for now, but as we've seen in the NBA, it's only a bit until 3 years pass and the guy's an unrestricted free agent.
Yeah, until it's not. As the Al Franken, former SNL writer and senator, called it kidding on the square. Like when you joke, yeah, but you're not really joking. And so that's, I mean, listen, as somebody who has still some slivers of vested emotional interest in the New York Knicks, the idea of a 3-and-D wing who hits 40% of his threes, can guard, you know, all over the floor, and as we just mentioned, scales up and down his usage depending on what you need, feels like a pretty good spot. It would be a very nice player to fit in between those other players on the Knicks. But I think in the meantime, we'll just enjoy the, it is worth noting that maybe Mikal Bridges isn't happy. And if he is somebody who is not happy enough to where he would want to go someplace, I would imagine there would be an awful lot of suitors, not just the ones across the river.
There might have been a lot of suitors for Terry Rozier. We won't know because he got moved to the Miami Heat quite early in this trade period. So now we've got three relative big players that have already changed teams, with OG Anunoby to New York, Pascal Siakam to Indiana, Kyle Lowry, and a 2027 first round pick, which is lottery protected, which we reported on Tuesday, and it becomes unprotected in 2028. I didn't realize that the Heat have done those protections before. That 2025 pick is already out the door to Oklahoma City, which was sent to the Clippers in some other trade, which I couldn't track down the original deal, but their 2025 pick is also lottery protected, then becomes unprotected in 2026. So the 2027 pick is really like the first pick 2 years after that pick. That's the same type of protections, if that makes sense, because if it doesn't convey to 2026 and they're not able to trade that 2027 like that. So we'll see exactly when the pick comes out, but it's just another thing that gets talked about a lot this time of year to really like evaluate the quality of what these picks are. But to that, I just want to kind of have a little rant here and get your thoughts on it, Dan, because I was talking to one cap guy who I like very much respect their opinion, and he's made me a lot smarter over the years in our conversations. He was killing Miami, saying that, man, no one else was going to give a first round pick for Terry Rozier. So why'd you do it? And why'd you do it now? And I heard other people back when Pascal went for 3 picks to Indiana, which we talked about the quality of those picks, someone killing Indiana for saying no one else was giving Toronto 3 picks for Pascal Siakam, as if it's like some indictment. Like, if no one else was going to do it, but you wanted the guy and you beat everyone else, so what? Like, I think a lot of the discourse that we have online and through microphones, through cameras, that is very like reflective of what actually happens in the league too, about like evaluating every deal for the dollars and cents, about what the price point was and how much you overpaid or underpaid. I think we're getting like too concentrated on the exact valuations of what these assets are about and losing track of the fact that like, this is not a video game. This is not something where you can like plug into every deal into a calculator and figure out exactly like what the valuations were and what the price points were. Like, this is about winning basketball games at the end of the day. And like, we've talked about that a ton on this show throughout the last like almost full year of doing this, buddy, about how the games are about winning, and like all these trade talks and discussions and the notebooks that I put out and whatever, like, should be with the thought in mind of that ultimate goal of winning. And like, I don't know. I think that needs to be, I guess this is a reminder to like think about that context in our instant grades and reactions and whatever. Cause like, it's common around the league for, you know, the Wizards, for example, they've got this 2 first-round pick price point on Kyle Kuzma right now. And they're telling teams, we're not coming down. Versus other teams like Brooklyn, with our vibe check, like with Royce O'Neal wanting a first round pick for him, like there are teams saying, oh, no one's giving a first. So like, you might as well, like, it is smart business if you can recognize no one's going to give a first round pick for this guy. So let's only put 2 seconds, unless you want to go get that guy so badly. But like, there's a line there, I think, to straddle of being too cute and too negotiating, where like it's getting in the way of just like actually getting business done and making your team better.
Absolutely. And some of this is, and I realize it's somewhat hypocritical for me to say this, because I often lean on or use sort of analytics and the advanced metrics in the way that we evaluate player value and how somebody fits into the context of a roster, and you know, the relative quality of a player's performance versus whatever. Like, I think the goal of like trying to put a number on everything and an absolute value on everything and say, well, what is the opportunity cost of, yeah, okay, you got the guy you wanted, but if you paid an extra second round pick too many, then, you know, the opportunity cost of, you could have had that available to use in another deal down the line. Or yes, you sent that pick out, the first rounder out the door, and yes, it's protected for whatever, but like, if you kept that around or you waited 2 weeks, maybe you would have been able to get more for your dollar. Like, I understand front office members needing to focus on that kind of stuff. Like, that is their, it's a big part of their job. And but I also imagine that not everybody in the front office is focused on that. A lot of people in the front office are probably focused on who is the best player we can get right now, price point be damned, and can we get them today so that this guy we can have more runway to get this guy into our team, figure out how we play with him, give the coach an opportunity to figure out what he does well and what he doesn't, how we can maneuver around that on defense, how we can maximize him on offense, whatever. Like, there is a strain of like, well, why did they do that deal now? It's like, because they want to get the frigging guy. They think that guy's good, and they have a need. Like the Heat, for example. I know that they believe they lost last night. Terry Rozier's first game. Terry did not have a big game in that first game for the Heat. But this was a bottom 10 offense that was having a real problem with shot creation, that needed more players who could do something with the ball off the bounce. Like, maybe you get that guy at a slightly reduced price point if you wait 2 weeks, but also maybe if you wait 2 weeks, you're under 500 in the East with all your guys injured and they are in and out of the lineup and how little sort of flow this Heat season has had, because the Heat are perpetually down a guy or two guys and just trying to, Eric Spoelstra is the chopped chef in the kitchen trying to mix and match whatever ingredients are in the basket that day. So Rozier is another ingredient and somebody that provides something specific that they need. And so, yeah, like I think you're absolutely right. I think looking at it and saying, is this the best possible value we can get? I understand that way of thinking about things, but from a team perspective, it's so much more, I think it's worth viewing it more from the perspective of, are we doing everything we can to win? And like, it's refreshing to see the Pacers go and say, like, we're going to go all out for Pascal Siakam because we are invested in winning. A team like a franchise like the Heat, perpetually invested in doing just about whatever they can to win. Like, it's not everybody's frame of reference, but it's also like, I think much more, there are many more teams that are in that frame of mind now than there were maybe a decade ago. Some of that is probably advent of the play-in tournament. Some of that is advent of flattened lottery odds, you know, whatever the case may be. But it's maybe why we're seeing earlier movement. It's why, you know, why James Harden gets traded instead of Ben Simmons. It took till the trade deadline. James Harden is immediately. And it's because those teams had a vested interest in trying to be as good as they could, as soon as they could, to give themselves the opportunity to figure out what they needed and how to work best together. And then both those teams are playing like gangbusters since it, you know? So I don't know that it's an array of thoughts there, but I think you're absolutely right. Just because it makes you sound like the smartest guy in the room to say, yeah, but was that the proper value, doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right way to think about things.
But even like to the people who are making these deals, like Terry Rozier going for a first is certainly going to be a precedent setter for what the point guard market is going to be.
Right.
It's a benchmark in relation to DeJounte Murray stuff. It's a benchmark. Like Bruce Brown's not a capital PG point guard, but like he defends that position. He is a secondary ball handler. Like in theory, if you're looking for point guard help, like he was on the list for my understanding in Miami of potential guys to go help their creation ball handling void.
Yeah, he was so essentially like the backup point guard in Denver last year. Like, I mean, they gave him that opportunity. Now, you know, whatever, they staggered him in lineups. But yeah, he was like a backup point guard last year. They gave him the keys and said, do it. So yeah, he can play that role.
So I will not fault Toronto for saying we need a first for Bruce Brown. I will not fault Portland for saying we need a first for Malcolm Brogdon. I will not fault Atlanta for still saying we need two firsts for DeJounte Murray, because I think he is a class above those types of guys in terms of age, contract, two-way ability, what have you. That being said, like if a team is out there and is a Malcolm Brogdon or a Bruce Brown or Tyus Jones away from really changing themselves, and they're just not going to do it because they don't think they're worth a first, and no one else is giving a first, to me, I think that could be faulty logic and reasoning when you're preventing yourself from getting better because no one else is willing to be as bold as you are. So that's the rant. I am curious how Terry Rozier's deal will trickle down for the rest of the point guard market. Kyle Lowry, definitely someone the Hornets are trying to trade. And there are definitely teams that I think will sniff around there. We'll talk about that. We'll write about that more in my article tomorrow that is slated to come out at Yahoo Sports. But I think for now, we've done plenty of trade stuff. We've been talking for a while. I want to give an opportunity for Dan to flex about the intense amount of work he put into and all the thought and all the words he poured out for his all-star selections that are being, and I mean, the starters are being announced tonight on TNT. I don't know if our show will be out before that, but if you're consuming all-star and NBA content Thursday evening, we'll be right there with you. So Dan, give the people what they want. Who are your all-stars for this 2023-2024 season? Who should be going to Indianapolis?
Everybody but me. I'm not traveling. Or I got the kids on school break. That's why I'm not going. But
I'm not going either.
I mean,
there's a couple concerts I'm going to if you wanna come through.
That's good. I appreciate you letting me know. I think some of them were pretty easy picks. You know, like you didn't have to do too much explaining for why Nikola Jokic was or Joel Embiid were starting. I think the East Front Court was, I mean, pretty much everybody put it in Sharpie the second the ballot came out. And it was like, well, that's going to be Embiid and Giannis and Jason Tatum. They're like done and dusted, nice and easy. You know, two of the, or the reigning MVP and, you know, front runner right now, guy who's on top four, top five in everybody's ballot. And then Tatum is the best player on the best team. Nice and easy. Halliburton was a pretty easy pick for the one of my first backcourt spot there. I mean, I'm curious because I think last year he had an injury that kept him out of the game too, right? Or maybe I'm misremembering. I know he got hurt around January last year, but I forget if he was actually in the game. But I know he's had the hamstring issue that's going to keep him out for a few more games. I wonder if that's going to impede him. I hope not, because it's in Indianapolis. He'll be like the kind of prince of the city there. So I hope that he gets to be the host of the game. But MVP level, like maybe best offensive player in the league level this year. I had a fun stat in the piece that I don't have in front of me right now, but it's, I think it was something like he's producing or creating via assist, so points created via assist, 41.8 points per 100 possessions via assist. That's the most of anybody since 2000, which is as far back as the play-by-play stats website goes, like more than any Steve Nash 7 seconds or less team, more than any Chris Paul team, more than, you know, the late model Stockton Jazz teams, whatever. Like, he is rarefied air in terms of facilitating. So easy pick there. The second East guard spot is, I think a lot of people are going to, you'll see different answers. I've heard a lot of people saying Jalen Brunson. I very nearly went with Jalen Brunson. I decided to go with Donovan Mitchell. He's played fewer games. He's played fewer. There's a pretty significant minutes gap. I think around like 300 or so minutes fewer than Brunson. To me, the aspect of Mitchell kind of just elevating or about keeping that team not only afloat, but like in home court advantage spot in the East when you've lost Darius Garland, when you've lost Evan Mobley for the better part of a month, due in large part to like that offense stays afloat because of him. He's averaging like 28 points and 7 assists per game since those guys went down. I think they score like 17 fewer points per 100 with him off the court since those guys went down. Other guys are shooting the lights out. Jared Allen's beasting, but a lot of that is just because of how much attention Mitchell, requires and the way he's able to sling the ball around the court and set those guys up for easy buckets. So I went with Mitchell. I would not be surprised at all if it is Brunson. I would not be surprised if it's Dame or Trey Young. Like, those guys they're going to get a lot of support from a lot of precincts, and probably, all of them are, and richly deserved. Like, there's a lot of really good guards. Tyrese Maxey also, I forgot to mention his name. If I was picking reserves, he'd be on there too. But you're spoiled for choice for the last starting guard there. Does that strike you as, you sort of like, odd to Mitchell? Did that surprise you? Did that strike you as odd?
I just thought you were going to go Brunson. Yeah.
Well, I'm a homer, so there is that. We're perpetually trying to beat the allegations and make sure that you're not, just being railed upon. Also, every Knicks fan online thinks I hate the Knicks and have thought that I hate the Knicks for 15 years. Yeah. So that's fine.
What was really funny was when I was reporting on James Harden wanting out of Brooklyn to go to Philly, there were people online who were Brooklyn fans who were saying, he's from Philly, he's doing Daryl Morey's work. And then there are people from Philly who were like, he lives in Brooklyn, he's doing Sean Marks's bidding.
I mean, and of course the answer is you're always doing everybody's bidding as a good reporter does. So that was my five in the East. If we want to talk about reserves, we can. The West starters, again, there are some pretty easy ones. Jokic, I don't think I have to convince you too much. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Luka Doncic as the starting backcourt. I probably don't have to convince you too much of that. Although if I do, let me know. The forward spots, I think, are pretty interesting, and you're probably going to get a lot of combinations. My guess is that it's pretty, on most ballots, it's going to come down to four guys: Anthony Davis, LeBron James, Kawhi Leonard, and Kevin Durant. That's my guess. It's probably going to wind up being LeBron and KD just based on vote count, like fan vote. It accounts for half of the total there, and wouldn't surprise me at all if those guys, they are also certainly richly deserving players in media and player ballots as well. I went with Kawhi and AD. I think that the thing that has kept the Lakers afloat is the defense for the most part, because their offense has been terrible. And Anthony Davis has been the centerpiece of that. The numbers are a little noisy. They say that the Lakers give up more points per possession with AD on the floor. A lot of that is about opponent three-point shooting. I think opponents are shooting like 40% from three with AD on the floor. That is something that a defense doesn't really have a whole lot of control over. And Anthony Davis has been like a monster rim protector and event creator, something like 6.5 combined blocks, steals, and deflections per game. If you look at, and also you filter out like some of the bad defenders, you look at his minutes where he's not playing with Austin Reeves, and the Lakers have the best defense in the NBA. So AD, I think, and also like whatever, 25 points in on like 56% shooting or something like that, you know, like a monster in the post, a monster in the paint. I think has been maybe slightly overall better than LeBron. So if you're going to pick one Laker, I would put him in. And then Kawhi, like I wrote about the Clippers at some length about a week and a half ago, or a couple weeks ago. I don't even remember how long ago. Time is melting in my house and in my brain. But I think Kawhi Leonard's been maybe, like Embiid's been the best player in the world for the last like 2 months. Jokic is right there with him. SGA right there with him. I think Kawhi's been right there with those guys, like a top five player in the world for 2+ months.
Yeah.
The defense is back in a way that I did not necessarily think it could be for an extended period of time. He guarded in the space of, I forget what the game threshold was, but like in a pretty short space, he guarded both Steph and Wemby. And you're like, all right, you know, and third in the league in steals, seventh in deflections, while being like a 50, 40, 90 guy and the best isolation scorer in the league. He's just a terrifying presence right now on both ends of the floor. I think he's been better on balance, full stop, than LeBron. And I think he's been better on balance, full stop, than KD. So, and there's no like big minutes gap there. They've all played around the same number of games and minutes. So just like, who do you think was the best guy? I think that's been Kawhi Leonard this season. So that was my pick there.
Yeah, I am scared for every team in the Western Conference about the Los Angeles Clippers. They are very, very good. They seem to be exactly what they were hoping they'd become when they traded for James Harden. So now that we are at the end of the show.
Hang on. So if you want to read a whole bunch of stuff about everybody, I think it just went up. So there's like a load of words up there. Go and read them.
There you go.
And then if you're mad, you can find me on Twitter at Jake L. Fisher.
Well, if you've ever found Dan on Twitter at Your Man Divine, you might know that this man tweets quite a bit.
I do. I have a problem.
Are you aware you are really, really close, like probably before we record next week, to the threshold of 200,000 tweets?
It doesn't surprise me. I got on Twitter like during the 2008 Olympics. So I've been around for a while, been in this game for 10 years making rap tunes. And my defect, one of my many defects, is that I kind of always have little jokes bouncing around in my head. And when I'm not around other people, I need a place to put them. And this was the place to put them.
Yeah. That is such a sign of strong mental health and a life that's under control. And able to have the time and the courage to always tweet through it. And because
all
you
the way
do
wrong.
Stuff
just
like
all
that.
All the way wrong, but all right.
I mean, I only have 13,000 tweets. I joined Twitter June 2009. So that's a little bit of a disparity. So I wanted to do something to highlight your tweets.
Oh, no.
And
for the listener, I do not know what this is. Jake is springing
a
bit
surprise.
On me right now. Okay.
So, for example, Dan tweeted, at 6:27 in the morning, he tweeted, "Some days you wake up and remember that time you walked into a high school classroom, looked at the chalkboard and asked if that was Latin, struggling to pronounce the phrase, ah, delicatati balans, only for your friend to say, it's a delicate balance, Dan."
Yeah.
To which I will give you a story to make you feel better about yourself. In college, Dave Portnoy, before he Barstool blew up, came to speak to one of my sports media classes. And me, being a critical thinker, I looked at Barstool. I saw no ads on the page. I raised my hand and said, "Hey, Dave, how do you turn a profit if you don't have any ads on your site?" And he goes, "Why don't you turn off your ad blocker, dummy?" And that's what happened. But Dan tweets all these beautiful thoughts that are rattling his brain, as he said. I have started writing some down on my phone.
Oh, no.
Not for the world, but these are Dan tweets that I thought in my head. Are you ready for them, Dan?
Hang on. I want to make sure I understand the conceit. So this is like, you think this sounds like me.
I caught myself having a thought to myself, and I said, if I was Dan Devine, I would have tweeted this out.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, sure. Let's go for it.
The first one. A muffin is a muffin, no matter how small.
No, that's not me.
It's not you.
I mean, okay. It's inarguably true. It's about how you bake it, but like, no, that's not me. Come on. Where's the delicate balance?
Autocorrect is a hell of a drug.
I mean, it's true, but that's you're basically just ripping off Chappelle. I think that, think about how many times you've seen something like my delicate balance tweet, and like in the world.
As opposed to getting there, I'm building up.
Coming from the beautiful mind. So, all right, let's keep them coming.
Tired, yesterday's price is not today's price. Wired, yesterday's falafel is not today's falafel.
Okay, all right, not bad.
There you go. Because the falafel just doesn't, it doesn't keep the same crispiness. It's not
true.
A salad.
God, it's so true.
All right, this one's a little bit of a reach. It's icy in these streets. When it snows in Brooklyn, you can't walk to the bodega for a pack of cigarettes without risking breaking an ankle like you're guarding goddamn Allen Iverson.
I don't think that's a reach. I think that's me. I think that if any you know, insurance companies are listening, I haven't walked to the bodega for a pack of cigarettes in a while. So let me get that sweet good rate. But no, I think that's right. Like breaking your ankle like you're guarding goddamn Allen Iverson. That's very much in my voice. I think you're exactly right there.
We were building up to this.
What you thought was a reach is much more in line with where I'm coming from, I think.
There you go. Okay, this is probably the best one. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but here we go. God bless the guy in my pickup run who said he has over a dozen throwback jerseys that he wears every Tuesday, but also how his collection is much smaller than it was in college because his roommate took a bunch of them because he knew how fire his collection was.
That, well, I mean, from a journalistic perspective, I respect the integrity of it. I feel like I probably would have fabulized that one a little bit. I probably would have been like, the roommate took half of them, and then I would have come up with some kind of fantastical conceit for why the roommate took half of them. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, you're just trying to document your experience, and also saying like, God bless that guy. Like that's
God bless that guy.
That's
I was trying to have more sirs, my man, good gentlemen's, but that's what I came up with. Okay. Those are the five that I came up with.
If anybody's out there trying to write a Dan Devine tweet, you don't got to get my good man and my good sir in there. I'm not like a Victorian, you know, like Oliver Twist, mean guy, whoever that guy was. I don't remember. Maybe I didn't read Oliver Twist. The point is, I think if you want to write tweets like me, fall the fuck back, because you're not on my level. So really, that's what I think we need to emphasize here.
I was just trying to make you laugh. That's really all that was.
I appreciate it. And a little bit peek behind the curtain, Jake is trying to make me laugh because it's been like a real, I was like 4 o'clock in the morning finishing this goddamn column. My desk broke. Lighting is not working super well. Like, there's a lot going on here. And I appreciate, like, the next time you form your mouth to say something bad about Jake Fisher, remember that he was just trying to make his friend laugh on a tough day. So God bless
appreciate
him.
That.
God bless
appreciate
the man
that.
Who puts half of his throwbacks away because his roommate, whatever. There you go.
Yeah, I didn't land that one because there was typos that I didn't fix. But
probably because of the cigarettes you got at the bodega. Is that why those typos
were
in there?
I didn't buy cigarettes at the bodega. I was going to the bodega and I thought, oh, what would Dan say? And he would say that.
That's exactly right. I mean, listen, that was easily the best one. That was easily the best one.
Yeah, I felt good about that. I felt really good about the throwback jersey one, but I didn't stick the landing.
That's all right. You know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And but that Iverson one, I feel like was strong. That was a very strong entry. I'm a little bit concerned that like you've got my voice and like a real like North Star for that.
Oh, for sure. Well, I've said it too. Like there have been times where after I listen to Vinny's solo show, I feel like I think in Vinny's cadence, and I listen to Divine Intervention every week, hoping to one day get the invite.
You're for sure we're definitely gonna make that happen, like not right now, but like we're super gonna make that happen for sure.
So I'm just, you know, as I'm walking the streets, traveling this life, texting, calling, I'm just thinking of my colleagues. So for all of us here at Ball Don't Lie, thank you for listening to No Cap Room. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That would be great. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.